You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to OSI, and thanks for coming. On behalf of the fellowship program, where I'm a fellow, I'd like to welcome you to this discussion which we'll have tonight. I should mention that the fellowship program is a very new initiative within OSI, and we try to have as many public events with provocative topics as we can. So in tonight's event is part of this tradition, and we're very pleased to have two very distinguished experts on the Middle East with us to converse about the political impact that new media is having on political and social life in the region. So I'll start by introducing Mohammed Bazzi, who will moderate the discussion with Mark. And Mohammed is currently a professor of journalism at NYU, and he served for more than 4 years as Newsday's Middle East bureau chief, where he covered the Iraq war and its aftermath, and he also set up Newsday's bureaus in Baghdad and Beirut. He has written extensively about regional politics, Sunni-Shia tensions, and militant Islam. He also covered the wars in Afghanistan and Lebanon, as well as the Palestinian uprising. Last year, he also won the Arthur Rose Award for Distinguished Reporting and Analysis on Foreign Affairs, presented by the American Academy of Diplomacy. And to my immediate left, I have Mark Lynch, who is an associate professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University. He's a co-chair of the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communications. And next year, he'll become director of the Institute for Middle East Studies. He publishes frequently on the topics of the Middle East, with a particular focus on the Arab media and information technology, Iraq, Jordan, Egypt, and Islamist movements. His most recent book, Voices of the New Arab Public, Al Jazeera, Iraq, and Middle East Politics Today, was selected as a Choice Outstanding Academic Book. Lynch began writing his influential Middle East politics blog, Abu Aardvark, under a pseudonym in 2002, and began blogging under his own name in the spring of 2005. Despite, or perhaps because of the quirky name, Abu Aardvark, and you see it's very quirky, gained a wide following among Middle East policy professionals, journalists, and academics. And now, as you know, he is part of the blogging team at foreignpolicy.com. So, welcome.
Thank you. Mark is going to begin by giving a presentation for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then he and I are going to have a dialogue, some questions, and then we're going to open it up for questions. We have a good crowd, and we think we're going to get a lot of questions. And when the Q&A session begins, I'll moderate that, and I'll urge you to keep your questions succinct and to refrain from long statements. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Mohammed. And thank you all for coming. This is a really interesting event, and thanks to Evgeny for organizing it. And I am going to keep my remarks as short as I can, because I think a lot of people in this room have some strong ideas and probably some strong opinions about some of the issues I'm going to talk about. I thought it would be useful for me to say just a few words about where I come from in terms of how I approach the question of new media in the Middle East and where I basically see it going. And the bottom line that I'm going to come down on is that I'm a political scientist, and I really do think that the politics have to come first, and that it's very easy to be overly impressed by the impact of media technologies for their own sake, and that we can lead ourselves very much astray if we're distracted by the very interesting and exciting things that might be happening with media technologies if we don't pay more careful attention to the underlying political structures, especially in authoritarian regimes such as those that exist in the Middle East. I'm sure many people here were following the experience of the Facebook activists in Egypt, and I suppose there might be some people who were surprised at its more or less complete failure a few weeks ago. But I wasn't, and I don't think anyone else should have been as well. This was the attempt to use Facebook, this exciting new social networking technology, to replicate the experience of strikes from last year and to try and turn this into a snowball of political protest and change. And it just didn't work. And the reasons why it didn't work are things I'll come back to at the end of these brief opening remarks and kind of see why I end up where I end up. So I started writing, I started blogging before I started writing about Arab blogs. I guess in some ways I would describe myself as a participant observer in the Arab blogosphere. I started blogging, as Evgeny said, in the fall of 2002 and was incorporated in very interesting ways into the emerging Arab blogosphere. One of the things which Arab bloggers did in, I don't remember exactly when, 2004 or so, was they created some of the early pioneering aggregators of blogs, and iToot was one of them. And I was very flattered. They included me as an Arab blogger. And I didn't want to disabuse them of the notion, but it struck me as an interesting thing about the way that boundaries were blurring and the way that my writing about Arab politics on a blog was in some sense giving me honorary status as an Arab blogger, because I was talking about the things that they cared about. I was linking to them. We were part of the same linking network structure, if you follow the blog roles, the way people covered posts. And so I got to be a participant in the a participant observer in the Arab blogosphere from an early period. But at that time, I was not writing about blogging. I was writing mainly about things of interest to me, and at that time I was writing my book about mass media, about television, about Al Jazeera, and really focusing on the ways in which that new media technology was reshaping politics. And if you think about the difference between TV and especially satellite TV in the Middle East and blogging, you start to see some of the major differences. Satellite TV is something which reaches a mass audience and not kind of the much smaller concentrations of young activists who tend to be dealing with things on the internet. It's a much more top-down, even when it has the illusion of participation, like you see in Al Jazeera talk shows. It's still a top-down kind of thing. And that's what I was trying to trace. And I was actually a real skeptic about the importance of the internet in Arab politics because, in my experience, there were very few people actually online in the Arab world. And the early phase, that first phase when it came out, when you started seeing a number of Arab bloggers, many of them writing in English, oriented towards what my friend Ethan famously called the bridge bloggers, where their primary function was trying to explain their own societies to the West in English. And there was a whole wave of enthusiasm in the American media about Arab bloggers. And I was one of the people at the time throwing cold water on it, saying these are a minuscule, tiny proportion of political society, to say nothing of the society. Internet penetration was incredibly low. They were writing in English, and they often, in their blogging, they betrayed far more concern with, you know, Jane Fonda than with local political events, because essentially their self-conception was often of being participants in the American blogosphere, with their contribution being that they were Arabs living in Arab countries in that first early phase. But then I was convinced to start taking it more seriously as a second generation of more activist-oriented bloggers began being more tightly and deeply involved organically in political change and political progress and political activism in their countries. And Egypt, of course, is the most important test case of this, where you saw the organic relationship between the Kefaya movement, the movement for change in Egypt, and a whole bunch of internet activists. And now, I'm a political scientist, and that's why I think that what I care about is politics, and so it's when they started getting involved in politics that I started caring as a political scientist. But what struck me about these people was that most of them were activists first. And the internet, whether blogs, listservs, and various kinds of ways, SMS technology, they were tools used by people who wanted to be activists. They experienced a political opportunity, and these young people courageously, creatively, and in, to my mind, very effectively used a whole range of internet technologies to dramatically magnify their power. They punched way above their weight, I would say, the Kefaya activists in that period of 2004 and 2005. They were able to attract international attention. They were able to organize. They were able to get protesters on the streets and, of course, loop in the Al Jazeera cameramen to come and make them look like they were much bigger bigger than they actually were. They drove the political agenda in Egypt for a year and a half. You could look at other Arab countries, Bahrain, for a brief time, Kuwait. There's a couple of other examples that you could point to where you saw bloggers, internet activists of various kinds, being organically tied to dynamic, creative, and effective political movements. But still, what I came back to was the fact that these were activists using the internet. They weren't the creation of the internet. And if the internet cables were chopped off and they didn't work anymore, they would find some other way to organize and some other way to act. They might not be as effective, but they would still be activists. And so there, my skepticism about the importance of these people was overcome by their ability to actually do things. But I wasn't really, internet-driven as the independent variable, as the cause of these things. I was much more interested in the fact that in these countries there were political openings. In Egypt, there were a series of elections, a constitutional referendum, the opening up of the media. There were things going on which these creative activists could latch onto and make something happen with. When the elections happened, and the political movements, the political parties and candidates backed by these bloggers failed to win anything and were absolutely and completely swamped in the elections, it in many ways revealed the emptiness of the Kefaya movement in a straightforward political sense. But I want to be very careful about this because you could read what I just said two different ways, and I'm hoping in our Q&A we can talk about both of them. The first is that they really were punching way above their weight. They weren't that significant, and we can organize, and we should ignore them. They couldn't convert their energy into sustained, organized political action for change. But I can actually read it another way, which is to say they punched way above their weight. They managed to do things which there's no earthly reason they should have been able to do. It was a small number of people facing an authoritarian regime, and they did things. The fact that they failed has to be read against the fact that they were fighting against extremely high odds. And there's no reasonable reason to think they could have succeeded if by succeeding you mean changing the political system. I would say that the Facebook activism that I mentioned a few minutes ago is in some ways a lesser breed of this, less organized, less commitment, in many ways less creative, and just as helpless in the face of the sustained repressive power of the Egyptian state. But there's some other things going on there, too, that I'd like to come back to. Independently of just these political activists, I would say that there's a couple of other functions that I see these kind of bloggers and internet activists playing, which are not reducible to either speaking to the West or to being involved in actual political action. The first is a secondary category of what a number of us just call citizen journalism, that some people just start getting involved in trying to do the things that the local press should do but don't. This is the notion of trying to focus in on, say, urban issues in Amman and trying to find ways to cover the plight of the poor, the plight of the school system, that sort of thing, which falls below the radar of politics institutionally defined, but could play some kind of role. And a number of very interesting activists and journalists who are friends of mine in a number of Arab countries have tried to do this sort of thing. But what they've run into is the same basic problem that I was talking about with activists, which is that they're trying to do this in political systems in which they enjoy virtually no legal protections, and there's nothing to protect them from the consequences of their reporting. Journalists who are members of the Journalists Association have almost no protection in these countries, and independent freelancers who decide to start pursuing a corruption case in a district in Amman are that much more vulnerable. And I got very, very anxious for some of my friends because they were eager, energetic, and aggressive and wanted to do these things, and I could see them heading for trouble. And many of them got into trouble. And that's something we can come back to if you want. The last thing that I'm going to say and then open it up to conversation with Mohammed is something which I called, back when I first started writing about this, I called public sphere bloggers, it's not the greatest term. I used it because it fit with research I was doing elsewhere. But the basic concept is simply that for a lot of the people who were involved in electronic communication and blogging and the like, there was a fascinating play of ideas, a shattering of taboos, and the development of what were kind of semi-public safe spaces for dialogue and argument about politics, society, and life, which didn't have a direct connection to political action, organized political movements, wasn't really journalism, and it certainly wasn't aimed at the West. It was often written in Arabic, and it wasn't aimed at a wide foreign audience. It was more about them themselves and about exploring themselves and their ideas, forming relationships, and trying to figure out ways of engaging with a society which seemed to have no place for them. And in many ways, this, I think, is the area where there's the greatest opportunity to see long-term impact of blogging, the new media, and all these other things. The impact not on formal political institutions, not on elections, but on the bloggers themselves. And the new ideas, the fact that they become different kinds of citizens, empowered in different ways, with different expectations of each other, of their governments, of their societies. And I like to think that we're not going to know what kind of impact this has for another 15, 20 years, when these people who are now, you know, kind of young university graduates in their early 20s are starting to emerge into leadership positions in their organizations, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or whether it's an engineering company or a political party. The different expectations, different abilities, different competencies, and that kind of impact on themselves and on those with whom they argue, those with whom they dialogue, those with whom they network, might be the most important change. Now, this isn't very sexy, right? Because you don't see it happening in the streets. You don't see big strikes. You don't see changes of government. You don't see revolutions. And in that sense, it makes it much easier to miss. Many of us, you know, we want to see immediate payoff. We want to see, you know, we want to see this matter right away. And I don't think we should. I think we need to remember that we're talking often about groups of 100 or 200 at the most, young people with very little social capital, very little political ability, very little local power, being asked to confront some of the most repressive and effective authoritarian regimes in the world. I get very, very anxious when people such as myself and probably people in this room encourage these young people to get involved in citizen journalism and political activism and the like, when we have no ability or intention of protecting them from the consequences of their actions. Things which seem like a rollicking good game to a 23-year-old thinking that his or her connections in the West will protect them from the police brutality, the torture, the various forms of repression and harassment at the disposal of an authoritarian state, I think is a false promise. It's a bad check that we've written to them in many cases, training someone to be a citizen journalist when we haven't done anything to create legal protections to protect them when they run afoul of powerful people, encouraging people to get out on the streets when we can't stop them from being beaten up by the police who meet them there. These are pretty serious issues, which I think are both practical and ethical, which I hope that this session can lead us towards trying to begin to work through and discuss. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark. You made this very interesting point about these activists punching above their weight. And I think the natural question that comes up is, should we even try to help these online activists in different parts of the Arab world? And if so, what ways can we do that? I mean, also your remarks at the end, I almost sense you toward saying no, but maybe you can see it the other way.
No, I actually would see it the other way, which is I think that that people like this deserve a great deal of help and support, but I would go about it differently. The way I would go about it would be less focusing on these individuals trying to pick winners and support them and more on trying to work from the top down to try and influence and pressure governments, especially allied governments, to respect basic Bill of Rights freedoms, the freedom of speech, freedom of association, and freedom to not be tortured, you know, that sort of thing. And basically to create the kind of legal frameworks and spaces within which activists of any kind or democratic or citizens of any kind can operate. And rather than beginning from either the technology or from the individuals, I would say work on trying to shape the broad structures within which they operate. Look, Hosni Mubarak is never going to let himself be voted out of office. It's, you know, I mean, this is not going to happen. And if we try and put pressure on Egypt to make that happen, our pressure will be wasted. But if we're able to say, we expect our allies to allow citizens to express themselves freely and to not face torture and repression, and then put money and muscle where our mouth is, I think we could actually create the kind of space where these kinds of new citizens that I'm talking about could emerge and could evolve, rather than kind of running them headlong into a brick wall.
Let's stay with the Egypt example for a moment, because it's an interesting example where there's this long experience in the U.S., say in the case of Saadeddine Ibrahim, in the case of Ayman Nur, where there has been this struggle, so to speak, in sort of in upper levels of U.S. foreign policy of sort of stability versus democracy, and generally stability has won out. Is there a reason to expect that people can have a different change, or we can have a different result there when you're talking about lower profile individuals?
I think the best hope there is that by lowering the stakes, you can increase the odds of success. I mean, if you look at Saadeddine Ibrahim, if you look at Ayman Nur, I think that the Egyptian government went after them precisely because they were so high profile, because it was a way of sending a very powerful message to the United States and to anybody else in those societies who might think of challenging the president, that no one is untouchable. And Saadeddine Ibrahim had more powerful American friends than probably anyone else in Egypt, in the context of activists, civil society activists and the like, and didn't save him. You saw the same thing with the Egyptian government's response to the blogosphere, where it's not just that they went after kind of random bloggers who happened to show up at demonstrations. They went after Alaa Abdel Fattah. They went after, you know, they just knocked out Wael Abbas's teeth a couple days ago. They go after the ones who will have the largest chilling effect on others. So as a policy question for the United States, I think it's very unlikely in this administration that we're going to be seeing a lot of high stakes pressure on democratization, unfortunately. I wish they would, but I don't think it's going to happen. But by lowering the stakes, you might paradoxically be able to have more influence by saying, look, we're not asking you to be voted out of office. What we're asking for is these kind of smaller step kinds of reforms. And I do often come back to these sorts of Bill of Rights freedoms because they're things which, for the most part, the constitutions of those countries themselves supposedly guarantee. And that's the sort of thing where that's the sort of thing which I think, at least in my crude reading of an area which isn't the one that I specialize on, but my understanding has always been that's one of the things that kind of worked in Eastern Europe and Central Europe and the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, the ability to leverage these formal commitments in ways which seemed unthreatening initially, but which managed to have profound effects from the bottom up over a long period of time. I'm not suggesting a perfect analogy, but just a way of thinking how you might actually produce the sorts of effects I'm talking about, even in the absence of the high-level pressure that is.
In your view, what things would be the threshold? What would be below the threshold as to not threaten the regime, so that the regime doesn't view this as a threat to its survival in the long run?
I might be getting a little too detailed than I can than I can get. I mean, I imagine that would be worked out in trial and error, in a sense. I imagine it would be tested early on, and it would have to be responded to appropriately, or else it would lose all credibility immediately.
Maybe it would help if we talk about some of the what you think has succeeded and failed out of past experience. Sort of in different countries, give us some examples of failures and success, and why.
I was actually fascinated by what happened in Kuwait in early 2006, because in Kuwait, there was always, whenever anyone did typologies of Arab blogospheres back in 2004, 2005, there was always one category in which Jordan and Kuwait were usually, you know, leading members of countries with really boring, ineffective, unengaged blogospheres. And the Jordanian one largely stayed that way. But on the other hand, the Kuwaiti one suddenly, and for reasons which remain relatively opaque, became extremely effective for a short period of time. And this was linked to the succession of the emir and the opening of the political space which followed, and the ability of bloggers to actually put a series of issues on the public agenda which a lot of other people would have preferred to not appear on the agenda. And what really struck me about that was that it's one of the things which led me to the argument that the politics come first. In other words, I didn't see a great deal of antecedent conditions which would have led me to think that Kuwaiti blogs were about to become influential. The politics changed, and all of a sudden, these people had tools at their disposal to take advantage of that political opening. And so with the political opening, then these people who 2 weeks earlier had seemed somnolent and ineffective and detached suddenly weren't. So in a sense, I would almost say, once again, it begins with the politics. You can look at some other cases where I think things didn't go so well, and that would usually be because of the way the politics intruded. I think Bahrain is one of the most fascinating cases where you had an extremely vibrant, not exactly a blogosphere, it was more on forums than on blogs, but a group of human rights activists and political activists who were able to kind of really ramp up a whole bunch of political activism, get some attention from the West, and have some real impact. But they ran afoul of sectarianism. And the kind of some of the things which were implicit in the kind of the basic structures of the Bahraini state, which is for those who don't know, is a Shia majority country ruled by a Sunni dynasty. And when pushing for human rights and democratization, they then ran into the buzzsaw of the sectarianism and kind of went over the red lines and shut down. But again, is that a success or a failure? I don't like those terms. Because it's too complex of a case to simply say that they succeeded or failed. They managed to have an impact considerably greater than one would have predicted because of their use of these internet forums. It wasn't enough to change Bahrain, but who would have thought it would be?
Is there one place you can single out where you've seen a sort of physical or a manageable kind of impact of this new media? I'm thinking back to Egypt, if we can bring the discussion around to Egypt again, and maybe we can talk a little more about success, failure in Egypt, or just what, the idea of punching above their weight and in which ways they were able to successfully do that.
I mean, I think that, again, it's too simple to say succeeded or failed. I would say that in the period of 2004 to 2005, the Egyptian, largely internet-based activists, I think, succeeded in that they drove the public debate. They were able to get people into a series of very creative and effective protests. It wasn't just because of the internet. It was because they were creative, effective political activists taking advantage of a political opening. But then that political opening shut down, and they proved unable to adapt to that new political environment. And so the rise of the Facebookian, as they're sometimes called, is in many ways a creative adaptation to the fact that the identifiable, highly committed activists were being driven away from political activity. A number of them left the country. A number of them got out of politics after paying pretty significant personal costs. And the Facebookian were a different kind of sort because the Facebook groups were totally different from the way Kafaya was organized. It wasn't networks of disciplined, energetic activists. It was a very costless, very simple, you know, it's easy to join a Facebook group. It doesn't mean anything. And the low cost of entry means that you can get large numbers of people to hop on board, but it also means that imposing even slight costs then drives many of those people away. And that's largely what I think happened with the Facebook activists. It was concealed, I think, because the first attempt to do a Facebook organized protest coincided with a round of labor protest, which made it appear that, I mean, there was much less linkage, I think, between the Mahalla protests, which were actually very serious protests, but were largely carried out by factory workers who, trust me, were not spending their time on Facebook. But they were the meat behind the kind of the fizz of the Facebook activists the first time around. This time, when they tried to organize it, they got exactly the results that I would have expected. People were the kinds of people attracted to joining a Facebook group are not the sorts of people in general who are ready to go out and risk getting hit over the head with a club and getting fired from their job and risking getting sodomized in jail because they want to transform the political system. It's just a different level of commitment. And I think that Facebook and those kinds of social networking organized movements tend to be very low commitment. And for that exact reason, not likely to have much of a enduring effect at the political level. So I would say that you have a period of success and then a period of failure. And I think right now, unfortunately, we're in the period of failure.
Do you see some of these activists adjusting their strategy? Do you see them learning from the periods of failure?
I think that what I get when I talk to these kind of this older generation of activists and when they reflect on their experience, what I come away with is a profound sense of frustration and being a bit at a loss as to how to proceed. I mean, in other words, it's not clear how one takes on an authoritarian state. And it's not their fault that they haven't figured it out because no one else has figured it out either. Many of them are reflective. Many of them seem to be reflective in the past tense. And a number of the more prominent ones, as I mentioned, have left the country and are now pursuing other opportunities. Others have become international celebrities and are doing well on the conference circuit, but maybe are less involved in kind of the organic domestic politics the way they once were. And I see a real sense of fragmentation and frustration in the Egyptian case in particular. And then in other countries, it's kind of, my sense is that the blog-led activism has more or less run its course. It took governments by surprise. It took them some time to figure out how to respond. Once they figured out how to respond, their vastly superior power came to bear. And, you know, so the blogs gave the activists a temporary advantage until governments adapted, but they did. Facebook and social networking strikes me as unusually poorly suited as a technology to challenge this kind of authoritarian structure, and I don't expect it to, and I'm not sure what comes next. We can talk about Twitter, I suppose.
Let's open this up to questions. Please, I think you need to go to the microphone, or are we going to take the microphone around?
Ask the first question.
Yes. Sorry. Please.
I'd like you to expand a little bit more on this idea of governments adapting to the threats posed by new media and blogging. What we see in countries like China and Russia, for example, is that governments are actually increasingly going beyond mere censorship and intimidation and actually creating their own new media ventures and paying people to go online and actually leave pro-government comments. I'm just wondering if you see anything like this in the Middle East at all, and what are some of these adaptation strategies that you outlined, other than just going and beating people up?
We have seen some of those things, and because they're carried out by, you know, secret intelligence services, it's very difficult to prove. You guys have done some great stuff in tracking down the IP addresses of things like that. But there was all the way back to 2005, we saw, for instance, a whole series of abusive comments starting to appear in the in the comment section of the most blogs. We saw blogs which appeared, made a big splash, and then began adopting very destructive lines. But then, you know, there's a fine line. And I remember asking Wael Abbas about this, and he was complaining about it, and this is going to answer both sides of your question. And I was like, Wael, how do you know that it's the government and not just someone who doesn't like you? And he said, because I track their IP addresses, and all the comments came from the same IP address in the Mukhabarat building in Cairo. And I was like, okay, you win. but a subtler form of that, though, is my friend Nassim Taraune, who's a Jordanian blogger, who had written some stuff which I guess got a little too close to the royal family's dealings, and he got in some trouble. Mm. And then it was like this big heartwarming story. He gets called by the king, and the king comes in, and he goes in and he meets the king. It's very exciting. And he gets to have a nice conversation, and the king reassures him that he supports the youth and their activism. It's a very friendly conversation, no threat whatsoever. And a couple days later, the king leaves a comment on Nassim's blog, and that's all very nice. I, as a Jordanian citizen, would not be reassured by the notion that the king is reading my blog, no matter how friendly he is. And so, again, you have these maybe subtle, but subtler ways of doing it, but still the notion that this is not costless, people are paying attention, creates a new set of kind of internalized red lines.
Well, people paying attention is partly what I wanted to ask you about, but people outside these countries. You distinguish between the people who are sort of real, genuine activists locally, and those who are sort of more geared, writing in English to the outside world, which sound like a good distinction. But I'd like you to talk about the extent to which those geared to the outside world actually affected the way the outside world saw these countries and had a reverb effect on them, particularly, I guess, the news media in the U.S. and Europe and so on, and whether there's sort of a back channel way of affecting the internal dynamics in those countries.
You also introduce yourself, just for the sake.
Michael Massing is my name.
Very much, a great question, very much so. That's one of the key mechanisms that we did see, that certain bloggers became privileged interpreters of these countries and could have a profound effect. And they would do this because journalists, as you know, are often rationally lazy, and they search out someone who can be an effective interpreter for them. They trust them. Maybe they Google them, and it's even lazier than that. But for whatever reason, they find these people, and they trust them. Often in the case of a place like Cairo, they would actually know each other personally, and the journalists would actually be included on the SMS blasts and things like that. And there's a lot of ways that in various contexts, you saw this in Lebanon, you saw it in Egypt, you saw it in a number of cases, they had very sophisticated ways of trying to leverage international media coverage as part of their protest strategy. I mean, look, if Kefaya movement holds a protest in downtown Cairo and the media ignores it, then it's just, you know, 50 people waving signs. No one has it doesn't even exist. The Egyptian media will pretend it didn't happen, and they might as well, because really nothing's happening. You put an Al Jazeera camera there, or you put a ABC News camera there, suddenly it's an international event. And these people were smart. They understood that, and they were able to leverage that, I think, very effectively. The downside of it, though, is that if it's the case that the privileged English language interlocutors are unrepresentative of their local communities, then you can end up with a radically distorted understanding of what's actually going on in those countries. And I think in Egypt and in some of the other cases, there was some element of that, where people with views that probably were typical of 0.01% of the Egyptian population were being quoted as exemplars of Egyptian public opinion, and that's a problem. Now, you would expect good journalists to do a better job of that, but having read your work, I don't.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, Anthony Richter, Open Society Institute. Actually, your question led exactly to the point that I wanted to raise with you. I don't know if you've had this experience, but I've been in Egypt, and all of a sudden, somehow, when I turn on my BlackBerry, and I start getting, in English and in Arabic, I'm on the listserv of something which seems like the Muslim Brotherhood. And the whole conversation about the use of these kinds of technologies suggests, would lead one to believe that the people who are using it most and most effectively are on one side of the political spectrum. And as you yourself were pointing out, that might not be very representative. And this is not necessarily something new. After all, in the Iranian revolution of 30 years ago, it was the proliferation of the technology of the day, cassette tapes with Imam Khomeini's speeches, which helped to galvanize things. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to the use of these technologies by groups like the Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, and so on, because when one of one's own gets arrested, there's a furor in the Western press, but one does not hear about the inevitable arrests of people on the other side. So maybe you speak to the use by that part of the spectrum of these technologies. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I've actually written a lot about the bloggers within the Muslim Brotherhood, which I think is one of the most interesting developments of 2007-2008, when you saw the emergence of a cadre of, at its peak, it was probably about 150 young Muslim brothers who were blogging, and this actually was an unbelievable window into the internal dynamics of the Muslim Brotherhood organization, and it was shut down for the most part when the Brotherhood was feeling too pressured by the government, and it was kind of having like an airing dirty laundry kind of feel to it. It wasn't the right time for it. And it's come back a little bit, but not to the same levels it had back in 2007. The broader point is that there's absolutely no reason. I mean, this is a common kind of motif that I'll hear, that in some way internet technology, blogging and the like necessarily privileges pro-Western liberals, and I think it's completely wrong. I see absolutely no reason to think that. Muslim Brothers, just as one example, throughout their entire history have demonstrated a mastery of new media technologies and have generally been early adopters of every major new media technology, whether it's, as you said, cassette tapes or satellite television or, you name it, magazines. They were at the cutting edge of figuring out how to use new satellite technology to print their magazines and their periodicals in countries and thereby skipping cross-border censorship and all kinds of things like that. There's absolutely no reason to think that Islamists are disadvantaged by any kind of new media technology. I won't even tell you how many Facebook friends I have from the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. I have to defriend them because there's too many of them. There's just no reason to think that. Now, at the same time, this is fascinating if you think about it, though, because if you get to the point that I was making at the end of my opening remarks, that this idea of creating new kinds of individuals, new kinds of relationships, this is exactly what I had in mind. The notion that the leading Muslim Brotherhood bloggers in Egypt were attending the same political rallies as the liberals and the leftists and the Arab nationalists and the like. They got to know each other personally. They imitated each other. They formed personal relationships. When the secularist Ala Abdel Fattah was arrested, the leading Muslim Brotherhood blogger Abdelmona Mahmoud made a point of coming to his defense on his Muslim Brotherhood blog. He also came to the defense of Karim Amer, even though he absolutely despised mutually everything that he stood for, on the principle that you should have solidarity among political activists and bloggers. And that's the sort of thing which you probably wouldn't have seen 20 years ago, that kind of forming of relationships across ideological lines. And they clearly disagree on a lot of major issues, but they do have new kinds of relationships, and they've developed new patterns of interacting with each other, which I think is fascinating. And again, we're not going to know the implications of this until people like Abdelmona Mahmoud emerge on the Shura Council of the Brotherhood 15 or 20 years from now. Right now, he's a 28-year-old journalist. But if he stays on this path in 20 years, he's going to be one of those kind of liberal reformist voices on the council, and he's going to have different experiences and different competencies than someone who wasn't involved in this kind of blogging and the like. So that's exactly the sort of thing I have in mind when I say that the main impact is more likely to be on these individuals and their networks and relationships than on the wider political system.
Hi, my name is Tara Stu. To pick up on a couple of themes that you brought up, one, that there was that brief window when the Kefaya activists and the other sort of bloggers were out there and seemingly successful, at least in, drawing attention to what they were doing. And then that sort of fizzled out. And then this other idea of the, if the U.S. pressure on Egypt isn't so sort of high stake, maybe there would be some reform. I mean, the sense I've had is that the U.S. has never really put the sort of pressure like, we want you out of office. And many of the activists themselves sort of felt like the change came after the 2005 parliamentary elections in Egypt and then what happened with Hamas. And so I mean, what do you think of that as a factor into the sort of fizzling out of some of the sort of disheartening that some of the activists felt, and then, you know, the U.S. not saying enough about the constitutional amendments? And this might be a little off topic, but what your thoughts are also on the whole debate about conditioning U.S. Aid to Egypt or withdrawing aid based on human rights improvements?
I think you're absolutely right. What happened, I would say, in 2004, 2005, is that a lot of people, both in Arab governments and in Arab publics, were confused because the United States was saying all of these things about promoting democracy, apologizing for the past, and nobody was sure how serious they were. And in fact, this isn't, this is like old media now, but back then it was new media. Back in December of 2003, one of the most interesting TV shows I've ever seen. It was an episode of an Al Jazeera talk show, and it was a debate between Saadeddine Ibrahim, the civil rights the civil society activist, and Fahmi Ouedi, who's probably the most influential kind of moderate Islamist intellectual pundit in Egypt. And the terms of the debate were: should Arab democratic movements accept the help of the United States? Now that was the debate. And Saadeddine basically said, we have no choice because there's no other power capable of influencing Arab governments. So if they're offering help, we should take it because, you know, it might not work, but without it, we have no hope. And Fahmi Ouedi's response was, there is no hope because American strategic interests require Arab dictators who will prevent the people from doing what they want to do, which is to oppose Israel and to do a whole bunch of things inimical to American foreign policy. And so anyone who counts on the United States will be frustrated. And that was kind of one of the earliest and highest level salvos in that debate. And I would say that, you know, after watching what happened in 2005, 2006, and where we are now, I think fairly unequivocally, Ouedi was right and Saadeddine was wrong. And I think if you talk to Saadeddine now, he would say the same thing. And it's a sad statement, but I think it's the reality that many people are living with. I would actually date, in response to your chronology, I would actually date the change much more specifically than that. The change came in the second round of the November 2005 parliamentary election. The first round, the election is carried out in three rounds. In the first round, the Muslim Brotherhood was sweeping to a victory. In the second round, in kind of the next round of seats, the Egyptian government came out in considerable force and began very overtly fixing the election, like literally, like surrounding voting booths with troops in Muslim Brotherhood districts so people can get in. I mean, at that level. And we didn't do anything about it. And, a few, State Department expressions of concern, perhaps, but nothing followed from it. And I think from that, and then, of course, then you get to the Hamas election, and then that was it. But I think that was when I would date the really substantial change.
Mark, you want to address the second part of the question about conditioning aid to human rights record?
Yeah,
of Egypt, I think, but you're also asking about the region as a whole as well, right?
Yeah, it's come up because I know,
in Egypt specifically.
I'm in favor of it, but I think I'm a minority on that, even among democracy activists, because they feel it's a very blunt weapon. You know, how do you get credibly to the threshold at which aid will be withheld? I would actually set the threshold quite low, and I would have the cost quite high. But, you know, I guess that's easy for me as an academic on the outside to say that. I'm in favor of it. That said, what happened with the last attempt to impose conditionality was that the message got hopelessly muddled because it began as conditionality tightly tied to human rights and democracy. But then once it got into Congress, a whole bunch of things related to the monitoring of the tunnels into Gaza and kind of Israeli-Palestinian issues were piggybacked onto. And at that point, it was very easy for the Egyptian government then to just say, this has nothing to do with democracy. This is all about Israel and everything. And the message was so hopelessly muddied that conditionality couldn't have the desired effect. So if I were able to design it, I would say conditionality should have a very low threshold, it should have high costs, and it should be very tightly focused rather than kind of a grab bag of things we don't like. That's how I would design it.
Next question.
I'm Peter Molnar from the Central European University, and
I have two questions. One is, you mentioned how bloggers who write critical stuff, explore sensitive issues, are likely to get in trouble. If you could talk a bit more about how, so is it like legal trouble, and if so, by what regulations, hate speech laws, defamation laws, state secrets laws, or it's just violence and harassment against them, or it's a combination of two. And the second question is that, comparing the activities that you described to the Samizdat underground press in the former communist countries and the long-term impact, those small circulation papers multiplied in conspiracy didn't have a quick impact neither. But what was there was a powerful concept of freedom and democratic open society. So the organized free channel of communication pushed a concept of freedom which included freedom of communication, actually probably the only concept that includes freedom of speech. So to what extent the communication activities you describe include that concept? Because it seems to me that without that concept, whatever long-term impact they might have, freedom of speech will be not included there. Thanks.
I think your second point about the Samizdat publications kind of said what I was trying to say much better than I said it. I mean, that's exactly the sort of point that I was trying to make about the way that, even if it's a small number of people, even if it's not widely read, the kind of impact that it could have over the long run in terms of changing that culture is quite significant. I mean, one thing to think about is that it's not just bloggers. In general, the Arab politics, modern Arab politics, has been the province of a relatively small number of urban elites. And so if you could say that, and so if you say that, oh, well, it's only a small number of urban elites who are on the internet and engaged in these things, that's true, but it might also not matter as much as people think in terms of trying to gauge its actual political impact. And so these kinds of issues that I was trying to point to about how changing the political culture, changing the personal competencies and the like, I'm not sure the Samizdat is a perfect analogy, simply because of that was a private, that was semi-private, and the blogs are maybe semi-public. I wouldn't say that it was either fully private or fully public, but I would say that the blogging stuff leans more to the public side and the Samizdat leaned more to the private side. So I'd have to think more about how that the ideas would percolate up to the wider society in each case. In terms of what kind of trouble people get into, I mean, I think that the things you mentioned and many more, and it's country by country, mechanisms differ. There's social pressure, there's legal harassment, the famous case of Karim Amer, who was cited for insulting Islam. There's a whole series of ways that you could go about imposing costs upon these people. It is so easy for a blogger or a journalist to show up in the desert with no fingers, which is what happened to a crusading Libyan journalist a few years back. He was exposing corruption, and then his dead body was found in the desert with all of his fingers cut off. And that's the sort of thing which just happens in a lawless authoritarian society without legal protections. It could be a direct and overt message from the authorities. It could be the sort of thing you can never trace who did it, but, you know, are they regime thugs, plain clothes, or in uniform? Does it make a difference? You know, there's a lot of ways that people can be made to pay costs. And this is not unique to bloggers. In other words, this is something which is, I think, deeply endemic to and built into the structure of politics in most of these countries, is the notion of there are red lines which shouldn't be crossed, and there's a cost for crossing them when you do. Sometimes that can be legal and formal, like in Morocco or Jordan, where you're not allowed to talk about the royal family and criticize it in any significant way, and doing so keeping in mind that these are the actual rulers of the countries making the effective decisions, so it's very difficult to actually talk about politics if you don't talk about them. But if you do, even if those countries were acting 100% in accordance with the rule of law, those bloggers are still going to go to jail for a long time, or journalists or anybody else. And then you have the more informal ones like I was describing a few minutes ago. So there are myriad ways of going about intimidating and imposing costs upon these individuals. And the very public nature of blogging is, in one sense, what makes these people so vulnerable.
Gideon Litchfield from The Economist. I want to cast a little skepticism on the thing that you said at the beginning, that possibly the best policy recommendation is for Western governments to lean gently on authoritarian regimes to respect basic Bill of Rights freedoms rather than kicking up a stink when there's a high-profile arrest. And I'm skeptical for a couple of reasons. One is that when Western governments feel the need to put on that kind of pressure, it's usually when there is a high-profile arrest. Rather than, and if people like Ayman Noor are not getting locked up, then the fuss usually dies down because there's less pressure on the politicians at home. Second, because I think the policymakers in the West know very well, as you yourself said, that the people who most benefit from, or who are best able to use new technologies, are the people that the West don't like very much, the Islamists. And so any kind of liberalization that they encourage is likely to benefit the people that they don't like to see in power. So there's in fact no incentive for the Western governments to make that kind of pressure. And third, if it is true that most of the liberal debate in Arab societies is taking place within certain urban elites, then maybe whether or not the country is wired up, whether or not there is freedom of expression on the blogosphere, the discussion among those people is not going to reach very far anyway. And in which case, if you're going to do democracy promotion, and I have to say I'm not that great a fan of democracy promotion, but if you're going to do it, maybe you should be directing the efforts more at, you know, the rather large group of young people in those countries who are not particularly politicized at the moment, but are very wired. And in that case, how do you reach them?
Those are all excellent questions. I wouldn't pose the argument that I made about slow pressure versus the defending high-profile cases as an either-or. I didn't intend it that way, but I think there are real limitations to just doing it with the high-profile cases. And I remember back when Alaa Abdel Fattah was arrested, he got a statement from George Bush coming to his defense, and I remember talking to him, and he thought that got him another month in prison, because it raised his profile so much that then the government couldn't back down. And then when he was finally released, the pressure on Egypt ended, but the other three people that were arrested at the same time stayed in jail and nobody noticed or cared, because now all the international pressure diffused because he was out of jail. And I think that experience really shaped my attitude on that, on those kind of high-profile cases. It's particularly, I think, bad when the high-profile cases are the ones that are the most obviously ideologically convenient for the United States. So Karim Amer, who is an anti-Islamist blogger, receives unbelievable levels of Western attention, frequent editorials from the Washington Post, statements from the State Department, and that's good. But at the same time, someone like Abdulmona Mahmoud, the Islamist blogger, arrested at the same time, isn't mentioned at all. And it creates a very strong sense of hypocrisy about the whole thing. Now, you could say, well, that's fine. You defend your friends and you don't defend your enemies. But I think that's a short-sighted way of thinking about it. I think that you're much better off simply trying to shape broadly a playing field in which human rights and freedom of expressions are protected, and not try to pick winners. Because if you pick winners, if you pick winners in the Arab country, you turn them the Arab world, you turn them into losers. And one of the worst ways, the easiest ways to delegitimize somebody in those political spheres is to paint them as a tool of the United States. And, and this is the famous kiss of death argument. And it might be exaggerated, but it's real. And if you can establish credibility by demonstrating that your commitments to human rights span everybody, you actually get far more credit for it. I think that Egyptian publics and Arab publics would have been shocked and stunned if the Bush administration had issued a statement in defense of Abdulmona Mahmoud. Didn't happen, but that would have been an opportunity to demonstrate that this was actually a sincere commitment to the principle of human rights and freedom of expression, as opposed to picking winners and defending one side over the other. Now, your concerns you raise about the distribution of power within these societies and what would actually happen with democratization is an obvious problem from the perspective of people who want to see distinctive outcomes in those countries. I personally am far less worried about that sort of thing. If you have groups that are invested in playing by the rules of the game, they renounce violence and they commit to democracy, then let them compete. Doesn't bother me that the AKP is ruling Turkey. I think Egypt would be much better off today if you had seen the Muslim Brotherhood win 200 seats in the last parliamentary election. They would have had a blocking majority and been able to prevent the fairly disastrous revisions to the Egyptian constitution, which the NDP was able to railroad through because they had a veto-proof majority in parliament. And I think if they had been in a position to impose some kind of accountability on the executive branch, Egypt would be far better off today. So, again, this isn't to minimize the very real and I think very very real concerns about what would likely happen in that situation. But I think in the wider context, it worries me less than some of the other things that happen.
Hi, I'm Jillian Regan. I'm a reporter from the New York Observer. I just wondering if we could talk a little bit sort of about Iraq and sort of the state of new media technology there. Is it more mobile-based because a lot more people have phones there than web access right now? And also, sort of maybe going off the previous question, right now there, the State Department invited CEOs from several new technology companies, Twitter, Google, Meetup, to meet with government on Iraq in our side and in community organizers. And I'm just wondering what you think about that. Is it just a press, you know, thing, or is it something real? Are they trying to, you know, implement new technology into the new government?
What's fascinating about Iraq is that this is actually a place where you can actually, in a sense, you have a tabula rasa. You have, you know, the emergence of a new political system, a new media sphere in which you're not going up against a heavily capitalized and deeply entrenched kind of institutionalized media space. So you look at Egypt, I mean, Al-Ahram has, what, 20,000 employees? I mean, I don't know the exact number, but it's big. And it's been around for a long time, and it's going to dominate. And if you want to get into the game, you need heavy capital. And so you see a few new newspapers appear. They got a lot of money behind them. It's an expensive proposition. In Iraq, you have this total free-for-all, where you have a suddenly liberated media space and the emergence after the fall of Saddam of hundreds of newspapers, many of them affiliated with a particular political party or political ideological trend. They come and they go. They rise and they fall. And there's just a lot of ferment and things going on. Meanwhile, the official TV station is pretty much a disaster and has no credibility whatsoever. You've got the Americans starting up their own media. The Al-Hurra Iraq basically stands in for Al-Iraqiya, which couldn't win people over. And all I'm saying with that preface is to say that there's a lot of opportunities to do creative things with technology there because you're starting on a kind of an open playing field. So I think that, for instance, the independent news site Voices of Iraq, Aswat al-Iraq, has established itself as probably the single most credible and universally read source of news from Iraq because it's viewed as nonpartisan and credible and established itself. And that's not the way of saying, oh, well, Daily Kos is the biggest blogger. And that's kind of like a backhanded compliment because he's going up against all the vast mainstream media. This is actually saying that you can see an internet-based, independent news site actually playing a very important role in establishing norms of journalism and transparency of information and that sort of thing. But I do think, though, that in the case of Iraq, you also face some real risks with internet-based kinds of things. And if you compare it, say, to Lebanon, where you see a highly sectarian and community-driven distribution of electronic media And there, including the TV stations, where basically TV stations, new websites, everything is highly sectarianized along with the country as a whole, what you lack is that kind of common space where you see, you know, citizens engaging in common discourse and reading the same news and responding to the same kind of unifying stories about themselves. So if I look at Iraq, I become very worried about, I mean, this goes beyond like Cass Sunstein's assumption that you're always going to get people self-segregating. I mean, but when you're in, as we have been in Iraq for many years, you know, kind of sectarian mistrust, sectarian conflict, people going to media that they trust because their lives may depend on it, you can see the very real prospect that this kind of fragmented media space would lend itself very, very well to Balkanization, or I prefer Lebanonization. So that's kind of the pros and the upside and the downside of the kind of phenomenon you're describing.
Dean Kemp from Harris Interactive. Two quick questions, I hope quick. In terms of the time period that you've been looking at this, do you see a difference in gender equality going on? And secondly, your comment is politics come first, but in that part of the country, politics is religion and religion is politics, and how do they kind of balance each other out?
Those are both excellent questions, and I'm not sure I can really answer either of them. I haven't really studied the gender distribution of blogs, and so what I would say would be entirely anecdotal. There was one very influential Egyptian blog, for instance, which most people didn't even know that she was a woman because she was writing under a pseudonym. Where would you count that? There were a number, those Muslim Brotherhood blogs that I was talking about, there were a number of them that received a lot of attention that were written by women. Numerically, they were probably no more than 10 or 15 out of the 150, but, you know, they had some novelty value. One of them was written by the daughter of a leading figure in the Muslim Brotherhood, and so there was the idea that you could gain some insight into her father through her very personal and extremely well-written blog. So I can give you like anecdotal stuff like on that. Anecdotally, there seems to be a lot of participation of Saudi women and Gulf women, more than I think I've seen in some of the more Levantine blogospheres. But I really couldn't say with any degree of certainty. I think it's a great question, but I just can't answer it. On the politics and religion, I think you see both. And I think that, you know, one of the things you've seen in Arab blogs, Arab and internet-mediated communication more generally is it's a vast space. One thing which, despite what I've said about the Muslim Brothers and their blogs and that sort of thing, I would say that broadly speaking, as a gross generalization, the blogs were more politically oriented or socially and culturally oriented, and the really important religious discussions tended to be on forums. And whether jihadist forums or kind of Muslim.net or the Muslim Brotherhood had their own very widely read forum, and whether that makes a difference or not, throw out as an open question. Forums have different dynamics than do blogs. They're less personal, but on the other hand, they're much more directly and intrinsically dialogue-driven, as you see the unfolding of the threads on the forums. But that's been, again, I wouldn't put it as a universal rule of nature, but my general observation is that when I want to see the big debates among Islamists, I read forums. And when I wanted to see the kind of unfolding of the political strategies of the Kafaya movement, I would look at blogs. But then Bahrain was dominated by the forums. So again, I don't think it's a rule of nature, but that's generally how I've observed it.
I'm Lisa Rudman with Making Contact and the National Radio Project. I wonder if you could share any observations on new media and Palestinians particularly.
There have been some really interesting, there are some very interesting Palestinian bloggers who have really done some phenomenal work in kind of putting a personal face on Gaza, for instance. So Leila Haddad is very widely read, I think widely read, mother from Gaza who has, I think, been able to do that sort of thing. But unfortunately, I think it is close to a rule of nature that anything related to Israel is virtually undiscussable on the blogosphere, because it descends all too quickly into intensely ideological and nasty partisan rhetoric on both sides. Both the Israelis and the Palestinians both tend to identify the blogosphere as a zone of information warfare. The Israeli government has a special task force devoted to going onto blogs and posting comments and things like that. So it's not exactly a zone of Habermasian free critical reason in action, but anything related, in my experience, related to Israeli-Palestinian stuff. So in terms of blogs and Palestinians, the most interesting impact that I've seen has, I suppose, been the kind of the humanizing face by a handful of these people. And if you think about it, you know, someone blogging from Gaza where there's virtually no Western reporters at all and it's basically a blank space for most people, that can have a pretty an impact like we saw like with Riverbend out of Iraq or that sort of thing. But in my experience, it's fairly thin on the ground, though. There's not a lot of it that I've really that I've seen that's been had a huge impact.
I'm Zoe Young. I don't mean to distract the conversation too much, but I was wondering if you'd had any experience with mobile technology and cell-to-web technologies. More of my experiences with Africa, and I was noticing with the Kenyan elections, sort of ushahidi.com was a website where you could text in human rights abuses that you'd witnessed, and it was really changing some of the political impacts.
I think this is one of the places that it's going. And you already saw this back in, again, everyone always talks about Egypt, but here we go back to Egypt again. You saw the SMS having significant impact in a number of cases already. For instance, the bloggers and Kafaya activists and others tried to organize election monitors, and they used their cell phones to record and to document a number of the abuses, which were later, that became a lot of the stuff of kind of independent electoral monitoring assessments. Probably the single biggest impact, as you know, came with the circulation of police abuse video, the video recordings of police abuse, which circulated widely via SMS, and that actually had a big impact on me, because I was, I wasn't really focused on that, and I was going through Egypt for a couple of days and meeting with people, and everybody I met, every single person, like 8 or 9 different people, at some point in the conversation, they would whip out their phone and say, "Have you seen this?" And I was like, "Wow, something's happening here." It was pretty nasty too. That's another example. And then on the sexual harassment thing, that was another thing which happened, which was that people using their cell phones were able to capture some pretty shocking footage of women being sexually harassed during a public event. And again, that then circulates and is posted onto blogs, but also onto mainstream media sources, and also circulated via SMS technology. So yeah, you're already seeing that. What I actually think is, if you want to look for a quantum leap, generally my experience in Arab capitals is that everybody I know, no matter how poor they are, has a phone at least twice as good as mine, and usually more than one. And right now, I would say that the iPhone is the state-of-the-art technology, and an iPhone is, I'm sorry, I don't know if there's any non-Mac users out there, I apologize, but it's pretty awesome what an iPhone can do. Now, it'll be obsolete in about 2 months, in about 6 months, but when iPhone technology becomes standard, and that's the kind of, the power of an iPhone widely disseminated and basically in the hands of all the kinds of people we're talking about now, strikes me as an enormously powerful weapon, the things you can do with that, whether it's coordinating terrorist attacks or whether it's trying to do the sorts of things that we've mostly been talking about today. And so that, I think, is where the next quantum leap in technology and politics is likely to be, is handheld devices, not kind of web, strictly speaking, web-based.
Mark, can you just briefly summarize for everyone in case not everyone in the audience is familiar with this. It's just the videos of police abuse that were circulated by SMS in Egypt, Wael Abbas posting those videos and the impact of that, because I think it's a very important example and people should know, you know, in a minute or two, if you can summarize what happened.
Yeah, no. Basically, someone captured an instance of what is apparently quite typical of just kind of a random and typical case of guards in a police station brutalizing a prisoner and sodomizing him with a billy club, and it was pretty shocking, and it circulated widely, attracted a great deal of attention. And actually, the end of it, the end of Wael's story, is that he actually ended up getting the guy prosecuted and put in prison, the first time anyone has ever been brought to account for such acts of police abuse. So it actually was a pretty powerful story. But then you then say, well, what lessons are drawn from it? Well, you know, if I'm a policeman, the lesson is confiscate cell phones and step on them. I mean, again, this is what I'm talking about, is that the activist might have the first mover's advantage, but then the other side catches up pretty quickly. And that's always, you know, as depressing as it is, that does tend to be the reality. Interesting coda to that story is that this journalist friend of mine who works for Al Jazeera wanted then to make a documentary about this for Al Jazeera, and she got herself into big trouble because she decided to recreate the event, i.e. get someone dressed up like an Egyptian policeman and recreate the episode. The Egyptian government said, look, external critics of Egypt are fabricating evidence to defame Egypt, and it ended up kind of blowing up in everybody's faces. There's no particular lesson from that, but it's kind of an interesting coda to the whole case.
Our last two questions.
You mentioned in the course of your discussion about the Obama's administration that you're a bit disappointed or worried that he's not really pushing democracy and freedom. But don't you think that he has learned his lesson, that every time United States talks about freedom and democracy from the Iranian Revolution up to now, the result has been absolutely disastrous. Iran, which we know what the mullahs are in power, Iraq, we don't even need to talk about it, Lebanon, Hezbollahs are in power, and so on and so forth. So maybe we should just leave them alone and let them evolve, and you know, within the system that they have, because the result of having freedom in those countries is the Muslim Brotherhood and the Shia law, and that's not really what we want back there.
Hi, I'm Jerzy Czerwiechowski from Open Society Institute. Often in the media you hear about Arabic blogosphere, and you've been talking about blogs in Bahrain, blogs in Morocco. How much is this one space Arabic media, and how much is it national, sort of set of national spaces that are not interconnected?
Good questions. Okay, so on the second question first, technically, there's no reason why you shouldn't have a single blogosphere. It's all the same language, and they have many of the same political concerns. But in practice, it's a set of loosely linked national blogospheres and very inwardly focused, generally speaking, which to my mind isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, if everybody is talking about kind of region-wide issues, then I think you very, very quickly get a retreat to lowest common denominator. You know, there's not that much new that can be said. You know, if you have 10,000 blogs all saying we support the Palestinians against Israel, there's not a lot of value added there, whereas if you have 50 blogs in Jordan who are trying to deal with honor killings as a problem or something like that, it can actually make much more of a difference, because they're filling a gap in the domestic political space, which no one else evidently is willing or able to fill. So the general evolution, though, has been of national rather than pan-Arab blogospheres, except, of course, in these moments of crisis when, of course, everyone's going to comment on, you know, Gaza or on Hezbollah or something like that. But if you look, for instance, there's a number of Arab countries have their individual aggregators. So you'll have Jordan Planet, you'll have Bahrain Blogs, you'll have the Saudi Blogs, you'll have the Ala and Manal's Egypt aggregator, and they tend to be nationally oriented. There are a couple pan-Arab aggregators, and they are so unwieldy as to be unusable. I actually unsubscribed from their RSS feed because they were dumping 150, 200 posts a day into my RSS, and I just couldn't keep up anymore. So there's real trade-offs there. On the question of democracy promotion, I really disagree with that. I mean, I just think that, yeah, the U.S. has caused a lot of problems a lot of times, but I think that the United States has a deep and enduring national interest in trying to promote liberal values abroad and to spread democracy in some form or another. I don't believe that we can do this simply by pushing elections, because just holding elections is not what democracy is all about. It's why I think we need to work to build rule of law, civil rights, the kind of Bill of Rights freedoms that I was talking about before. If it were the case that this was simply a Western idea being imposed from the outside, which we always make a mess of, I might be more tempted to go with your line of analysis, but it's just not. In fact, much of what I've been talking about for the last 2 hours is a story of lots of young Arabs and Muslims who really want these things for their own reasons. They're not doing it because George Bush told them to do it. They're doing it because they think that their societies need to change. They think reform needs to happen. And a lot of this really does come from within. And I think that there has been a fairly strong consensus around the idea of democracy in Arab and Muslim politics dating back to the early to mid-1990s. And the general principles of democracy, civil society, the Muslim Brotherhood and its general circles have been signed on to this, I think, since 1993 when Yusuf al-Qaradawi issued his fatwas on Islam and democracy. Saadeddin Ibrahim's civil society initiative has strong roots in a number of Arab countries. There's just, if you watch Al Jazeera, they spend a lot of time talking about reform issues and the need for democracy and critiquing authoritarian societies. I think there's a deep internal condemnation of the state, the political state of the Muslim world. It doesn't mean that I think that they all want American-style democracy or they're pro-Western or anything like that. I think far from it. But I do think that there's a fairly deep and very important internal demand for change from within that I think the United States does have an interest in trying to promote, even if we do mess it up a lot of the time when we try.
Thank you.